Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-7028 et al. Wanda Y. Dickens, appellant. Marva Yvonne Glenn versus Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs et al. Mr. Mosley for the amicus curiae, Ms. Dickens for the appellant, and Mr. Love for the appellees.
Mr. Mosley.
May it please the court. Court-appointed amicus have present arguments on three sort of groups of factual issues and four legal issues. The groups of factual issues are related to appellant Glenn's failure to promote claim and also appellant Glenn's disparate workload claim. We're making arguments regarding both appellee's hostile environment claims and the appellee's constructive discharge common law claims. With respect to the failure to promote claim filed by appellant Glenn, the district court erred in holding that the failure to promote claim was time barred. The evidence in the case suggests that Mr. Howes, who was promoted into the position of acting branch chief, was so promoted in November of 1994. And the court has recognized that the EEOC complaint that was filed by appellant Glenn referred specifically to that promotion and the failure to promote Ms. Glenn, and that it was filed in 1994. As such, it had to have been filed sometime in the 2 months the month and a half or so between November and the end of the year. Therefore, it clearly meets the standard of at least of the 180 days required to file an EEOC complaint. As far as we know, at this point, Ms. Glenn did not receive a right to sue letter and still hasn't received one as far as the record is concerned. So because she hasn't gotten a right to sue letter, the statute of limitations is therefore told. And although she had the opportunity to potentially file a lawsuit after 180 days, she was not required to do so. And the fact that this particular lawsuit in 98 included claims from 94 and the failure to promote her claim is timely, given that the court has ruled that the 1998 suit is also timely. With respect to the issues related to whether or not this particular failure to promote is an actual failure to promote or an adverse employment action, we believe that the court erred in holding that this was a temporary position. It is true that the title of the position was acting branch chief. However, the individual who held the title of acting branch chief held it for 5 years before being declared the permanent branch chief and later was given back pay for the position that dated all the way back to the time he was acting branch chief. So clearly this was not a acting position. This was an actual promotion that Ms. Glenn did not get. And as such, it is an adverse employment action. And Ms. Glenn is alleged and has adduced enough evidence to go forward on the failure to promote claim, and she should be able to get to trial on it. With respect to Ms. Glenn's disparate workload claims, those claims are both a continuing violation and a hostile environment. With respect to the continuing violation aspects, what the evidence shows is that that Ms. Glenn was subjected to a system that continuously treated her differently than the other similarly situated supervisor who had wards 1 through 4. We believe that there's a factual error that the court made, or at least it chose the wrong set of evidence to rely on with respect to whether and when the or how long Ms. Glenn was assigned all four wards. There is evidence to suggest that Ms. Glenn had wards 5, 6, 7, and 8 all the way through from 1990, from the time that she was given all four wards until the time that she retired in 1997. So that the district court's holding or finding that somehow ward 5 was removed from her workload sometime before she retired in 1997 is, if not incorrect, at least inappropriate at this stage to have picked that one as the right factual inference to draw, given that there's plenty of evidence suggesting that it went all the way through to the end of her retirement, particularly at the summary judgment stage. with respect to whether or not this is a continuing violation, the district court found that there was one decision that was made in 1994 to allocate to Ms. Glenn a disparate workload, and that that was the discrete act, and that as a discrete act, it wasn't actionable. The evidence, we believe, suggests something different than that, that there were actually weekly reports that were filed with the supervisors, and Ms. Lewis, who was Ms. Glenn's supervisor, testified in deposition that they went over these weekly status reports and that decisions about workload were made every week, so that this wasn't just one decision that was made at one time and continued and had effects that continued into the statutory period. This was an incident that continued over and over and over throughout the statutory period and indeed went all the way until Ms. Glenn retired. In addition, the disparate workload claim is also a hostile environment. To the degree that the court might find that each one of the individual decisions was not enough in and of itself to sustain any sort of a claim on the continuing violation aspect, we know that the record shows that there's plenty of evidence to show that once you back up from the situation and you look at the situation entirely, one can determine that the disparate workload was applied to Ms. Glenn in order to make her leave the department, in order to show that women were not suitable as supervisors, and that there's evidence from Luther McManus, the subordinate to Ms. Glenn, indicating that in fact what they wanted to do was get rid of her, and that the applying of the disparate workload environment, I mean the disparate workload was a hostile environment in the sense that they just wanted to get rid of her, and that that workload was connected not only to her status as a woman, because they wanted to show that women were not suitable as supervisors, but also to show that, I mean, but also just to get rid of her, and in retaliation for her repeated acts filing complaints with the EEOC. With respect to Plaintiff Dickens' hostile environment claims, we believe that the district court erred in disaggregating each and every one of these incidents that happened to Ms. Dickens and then saying that each one of those was not independently actionable and then dismissing them. We believe, I mean, the record shows that there was action taken against Ms. Glenn in terms of failure to give her career ladder opportunities, failure to provide her training opportunities that not only occurred after she filed a class action lawsuit in 91 and after she filed discrimination claims and administrative discrimination claims in 1994, but also continuing into the time at which she was forced to retire from the department.
How was she forced to retire?
Ms. Dickens was.
You used the phrase forced to retire as opposed to simply retiring. How was she forced to retire?
Ms. Dickens was forced to retire in that the environment under which she worked became untenable for her in terms of the fact she wasn't going to get promoted. She'd been applying for career level and career ladder promotions since 1994, extending into 1997. She was continuously placed in positions where she was getting negative evaluations for positions that weren't even any longer in effect in the district.
This, you say, is something that had gone on for years, but what is it that changed that forced her to retire?
What the issue that changed that forced her to retire was, I want to say the change that converted all of the employees to at will, but the record is a little bit vague as to whether or not they were actually at will or civil service.
Not a very strong read to lean on to say that that forced her to retire.
Well, I think the standard is especially at summary judgment, is if a reasonable juror could conclude that the environment that she was under would cause a reasonable person to take retirement. I think this does meet that standard, at least at the summary judgment stage. She was faced with a potential firing as an at-will employee and was concerned about potential losses of pension. Under those circumstances, I think a reasonable person may be forced to retire under those circumstances. At the very least, these claims should be in front of a jury. The remaining common law constructive discharge claims are included in our briefing, and my time is expiring, so.
Okay, yeah, we'll give you some time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Dickens?
Good morning. In answer to your question, I was told that I would lose my pension. I have been fired from this agency on 3 occasions. I was out of work for 3.5 years. This time was different because we were never at-will employees and everybody got the notice. I was put on the RIF list in particular, and they had moved one of the employees who had my title out of the way of RIF, which made me the one to get RIF first. I want to say that the judge erred in not giving me another attorney because I had filed a motion advising that the attorneys had bullied both Marva and myself. They refused to do what we wanted. To date, I have not been compared to anybody that I was similarly situated with. I had the exact same duties and responsibilities in two different divisions than the men, and that's not part of the record because of the attorneys. I know that you have to get your record in below. Marva doesn't know as much about law and what little I know about law as me, so I told the attorneys that we needed to get certain done. They told us we weren't. They bullied us throughout, and I was forced to file the motion for appointment of a new attorney. And you can see that there is a great discrepancy between what those attorneys offered for Marva and what they offered for me. I returned to the agency after being fired and off for 3.5 years due to the second promotion. The whole thing started when they gave my duties to a man and converted everyone else to permanent employees. All the men got the better positions. I filed a complaint, and I wasn't promoted from then until the time I left, until Cedar ordered them to put me in a permanent position. I was then sexually harassed and fired. A man at the same time challenged his promotion. He had a great promotion, but he challenged his promotion. Nothing was done to him. Before I returned to agency, the Office of Employee Appeals determined that I had been treated disparately and ordered me back. During about the same time, I got a finding of discrimination from the Office of Human Rights due to the 76 complaint. The 91 complaint was based on retaliation, sexual harassment, violation of the Equal Pay Act, and hostile work environment. And when I came back, I was forced because they put me in higher level positions, which I worked. I enjoyed working the higher level positions. I want you to know that I have always received excellent, outstanding ratings, except for the one position that didn't exist. And, the one position that didn't exist. With respect, well, I already addressed being forced to retire, but I was reassigned based upon opposition activity on each of the occasions, and all of the witnesses that I chose said in each of the three different places that I was in that I was treated differently, that I wasn't promoted. I always performed at a higher level. And the second time I was ousted out of an entire administration because I assisted as a shop steward others to file discrimination complaints and helped others with respect to their issues. And mine wasn't the only complaints that were going on. Everybody was complaining in that agency because of the way people were treated. But primarily men were promoted. In every single division I was in, there was violation of the Equal Pay Act. They created positions for men. All of, in my last duty station, they created another job title for a man to perform the same work that the women were performing. They made him a supervisor. He came in from the street. There were only two men in that division. My promotion to that division, which was the last division I was in, was due to opposition activity, but I also was promoted to one of the two new positions because they had given my job away while I was on an illegal detail. And that's what happened. I applied for jobs throughout my entire career before and after I returned, and I was never promoted. Never.
Thank you, ma'am. Your time is up now. Okay. We will give you back a little time for rebuttal.
Okay.
After the we hear from the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Richard Love. I represent the agency director, currently Ms. Argo. If I could address the timeliness concerns on the failure to promote claim brought by Ms. Glenn first. Ms. Glenn, in her complaint, asserted that in the jurisdictional statement, the only reference to any EEOC charge is the 1998 charge. It's right in the jurisdictional statement. It's in the appendix at page 69. In her affidavit, in paragraph 14, it's also in the appendix, she indicates that the basis for this lawsuit is the 1998 charge. Both plaintiffs had brought a variety of EEOC charges. In defendant's motion to dismiss, it was raised that the 1994 alleged failure to promote was not filed, didn't fit within the 300-day limitation period. And there was no response in the opposition to that motion that is being raised now. In other words, that it was based on the 1994, not on the 1998 charge. The only defense raised in the opposition was that it was a continuing violation or part of a hostile work environment. So the court was absolutely correct in finding that the failure to promote claim was untimely based on the 1998 charge, which is the basis for this lawsuit. That's what the plaintiffs alleged. That's what the defendants asserted their defense based on. Even if the 1994 charge was the basis of the complaint, which we asserted is not, there's no evidence that there was a right to sue letter issued or not issued, and it is the plaintiff's burden to come forward. Yes, a complaint could be filed within 180 days if there is no action on the complaint, but I would submit that can't possibly run in ad infinitum. It certainly wouldn't square with the purpose for these time limits, which is to prevent stale claims, which certainly would be applicable in this case since this lawsuit would have been filed over almost 4 years later.
So I assume that your argument is that even if she didn't receive this, I mean, her counsel here just asserted that she did not receive the right to sue letter on the 1994 claim.
Well, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Well, I don't think the record shows that. I think the record is simply silent. It doesn't show, there's no evidence that she did not receive it or she did receive it. The record is silent. And as I said, I mean, our primary argument is this is based on the plaintiff's own assertion on a 98 charge, not on the 94 charge. That was never raised in response to the defendant's motion.
So there was a, there was a right to sue on the 98.
Yes, sir.
Excuse me. Did you have more?
No, I just, I'm trying to, this 1994 right to sue, your position is that it's because there is nothing in the record to show this. If there was, you might not be arguing that it was time barred. Is that correct?
Yeah, as a, well, it's an alternative argument because the 98 is the relevant one. But yes, on the 94 charge, there is no evidence that there was no right to sue letter issued.
How could there be evidence that there was not a right to sue letter?
Excuse me, sir?
How could there be evidence that there was not a right to sue letter?
Well, the plaintiff...
If there was not a right to sue letter, what would be the tracks of there not being one?
Well, Ms. Glenn could testify, or she could have stated in her affidavit or in deposition, that she never received it. And there's simply no... That's my point. There is no testimony by way of affidavit or otherwise that it was not received. There's simply a dearth of evidence on the point.
If there was a... Was there a deposition?
Yes, sir.
Did anybody ask her if she received one?
I don't, not that I read, but there was an affidavit.
The idea of proving a negative is not really consistent with normal principles of logic.
Well, I understand, but she did submit an affidavit.
Here is the letter I
didn't receive. She did submit an affidavit also, Your Honor, where she could have framed that issue.
What would have been the right occasion to submit an affidavit that she didn't receive something?
Well, it was submitted with the opposition to the defendant's motion for summary judgment. And as I said, it was raised in that motion that this claim was not timely filed because it didn't fall within the 300-day limitations period triggered by the one EEOC charge that she did reference in the jurisdictional statement in her affidavit. That's the 98 charge. And in response, she did not raise the arguments she raises today, that it was timely relative to the 94 charge. And if she had, she could have included in that affidavit an assertion that she never received it and made the same claim she raises for the first time on appeal. Okay. That's merely my point. Your Honor, if I can move on to the desperate treatment claims, they're really dependent on a continuing violation theory, and the continuing violation theory is not applicable here. This claim springs from, it's a consequence of or an effect of the original assignment to her of Ward 6, 7, and 8 in 94, or Ward 5, which was added in 1995. There's no difference in this situation from that this court referred to in Taylor v. FDIC. And that's the quote the district court uses, that untimely suit can't be revived by pointing to effects within the limitations period. What happened in FDIC v. Taylor is Taylor and a coworker, Pedersen, originally complained about being an assignment that they considered to be professional purgatory. That original assignment was within the limitations period. And the court said with regard to supervisors who, outside the limitation period, failed to move them from that assignment, that was not timely filed, and that it could not be revived by pointing to the effects in the limitations period. It's a similar thing that's complained of here. In addition, that case law, I think, is only reaffirmed by subsequent case law in both Morgan and in Ledbetter. Similarly, the district court, in its comprehensive opinion, went on to state that there also was no adverse action here, a change in work assignments alone. No, there was no decrease in salary or in work hours. And there was no discriminatory motive. The court indicated three different pieces of evidence that it relied on, including the testimony that all the supervisors were overworked. Ms. Glenn dismisses that as irrelevant, but it is relevant to whether or not there was discriminatory or retaliatory motive here. She also indicated that the assignment was of Ward 5 was taken away from her 1997 as a result of a supervisor's meeting where they redistributed the wards. The testimony of Mr. McManus in the district court also refers to this, primarily indicates that his opinions with regard to management's treatment of Ms. Glenn was because they didn't believe she had leadership skills. They questioned her intelligence and her attention to detail. And the testimony with regard to concerns about women were primarily about placing them in dangerous assignments, going out into dangerous wards where they might be threatened. With regard to the Ms. Glenn also asserts that an alternative theory that the court discussed, which was that even if continuing violation theory was applicable here, that it would be equitably told. And the plaintiffs assert that that is an equitable tolling doctrine would not be applicable to a continuing violation theory. In our brief, we dispute that this court ever found that, and that this certainly fits within that doctrine because there was abundant evidence from the conduct of both Ms. Glenn and Ms. Dickin over the years that they were aware from the start that this was a potentially discriminatory or allegedly discriminatory act. There also is a failure to demonstrate temporal proximity. Ms. Glenn argues that this occurred within a maximum of a year's period. Even if that were true, it would be totally speculative for a jury to find temporal proximity under these circumstances. But the record is very muddled. You'll find that Ms. Glenn complains about being overworked since 1989. There are numerous different references in the record as to when this originated. And at some points she says 1989, and another point she says early 90s, and another point she says 91, and another point she says with the assignment of Ward 6, 7, and 8 in 94. I think that only exacerbates the problem, and as the district court found, it said, as she provides the court with no concrete dates upon which any of the alleged retaliatory actions occur, it is impossible to determine this, and it's her burden to do so. This also doesn't fit. There's no other evidence from which an inference of retaliatory conduct could be drawn. This is not the case they referenced the district court's opinion in Bugs, where the manager who was making the promotion decision was actually, at the time he was making that decision, the subject of an EEOC investigation against him by the applicant. There's nothing remotely similar here. Turning to the hostile work environment claim, I think that the law is clear that the hostile work environment has to be premised on a severe, pervasive course of conduct. It's one unlawful employment practice. And for a claim to be timely, there has to be an act contributing to this singular unlawful employment practice that occurs within the limitations period. And the court certainly didn't disaggregate all of these claims. The court's opinion is very comprehensive. It points in great detail to the factual record and identifies the timely claims in order to determine whether or not that claim could be a part of a singular unlawful employment practice, whether it could contribute, and that's the requirement of the law, to a singular unlawful employment practice that was pervasive and severe. With regard to Ms. Glenn, the court properly identified the one timely act as the response in a management meeting to her complaint that she couldn't perform her duties, and the response was, you could be fired at will if you can't do your duties. That is not probative of a workplace permeated with unlawful discrimination. Indeed, it was in response to her complaints about work, not the fact that she was a female. And it was an isolated and disconnected event. It was It was totally dependent on this new memorandum directive that the recently installed Congressional Control Board imposed and was not a part of this pattern that allegedly was occurring over a 7 to 8 year period. Similarly, with Ms. Dickens, the court precisely identified two acts that were timely within the limitations period. Ms. Dickens complained about a pattern that occurred over a 12 to 13 year period. And neither of these events, the court properly found, contributed to this severe or pervasive pattern. The two events, of course, were the removal of flex time and her belief that she had been labeled a complainer. Plus, the court went on to indicate and point to the evidence that shows she did file numerous complaints, and also that the flex time was not a result, was a result of a male and female attorneys complaining about her use of flex time. Finally, Your Honors, with regard to the constructive discharge claim, I think the district court's comprehensive findings properly conclude that the plaintiffs were not subject to intolerable working conditions. The plaintiffs were not driven to quit. They were told of their conversion to an at-will status, as were all employees. This wasn't singularly directed at Ms. Glenn or Ms. Dickens. They made no additional inquiries to determine whether or not they had other options, and they chose an early retirement program that was available and offered to them. Moreover, constructive discharge claim is not an independent tort. They haven't stated a common law claim. Constructive discharge claim gets you around the quandary where an employer termination is required. So you can't make an end run around that requirement by
your red light is on, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Nobody has any time left. Each of them can have 2 minutes back for rebuttal. 2 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. With respect to, may it please the court, with respect to the failure to promote claim, first of all, the district court found that there was a 1994 EEOC complaint that specifically mentioned the failure to promote in the claim. And the failure to promote allegations are included in the 1998 claim. In any event, our position is that the fact that she didn't get a right to sue letter, and Your Honors were latched onto the issue here, which is that the plaintiffs were not going to be able to, Ms. Glenn was not going to be able to prove the negative that she didn't get a right to sue letter. Not getting the right to sue letter, the statute of limitations after an EEOC complaint is filed only starts running after you get the right to sue letter. So that she could have filed at any time on these 1994 claims. Because the statute of limitations was therefore told.
To the 94 and not the 98 claim.
Excuse me, sir?
That would look to the 94 claim rather than the 98.
Correct, but the 94 claims were included in the 98 lawsuit. With respect to the assignment of the disparate workload, in the first instance, the issue is not whether or not all the employees were overworked. The issue is whether or not Ms. Glenn was overworked in comparison to similarly situated employees. And there's numerous statistical evidence that is on the record that shows that her assignments of wards 5 through 8 was extensive compared to the other supervisors. This situation is different from Ledbetter and different from Taylor in that there was one incident that happened at one point where, and then later on, there were non-discriminatory effects of that into the statutory period. There was evidence to indicate the assignments were made weekly and that in any event, there was regular rotation of assignments throughout the department except for Ms. Glenn, and that every time there was a rotation that didn't include her, she was there for, that was a new assignment. The rest of our issues have been extensively briefed, and we'll have to rest on those at this point as our time has expired.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Dickens?
With respect to the hostile work environment and continuing violation, I want to say since 1976, harassment and retaliation never stopped. It just continued. with respect to the end of my career, if it can be called a career there, I will say that I was put in the direct line of fire. I was never promoted. Employees and supervisors, managers throughout the department were always talking about the complaints, but the complaints had to happen in order to for me to protect myself. Everything that I have ever said is documented with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission because I documented it. I had no choice. Nobody was there to protect me. And I guess that's about it.
Thank you, ma'am. Mr. Mosley, I want to thank you and your colleagues and your firm for the pro bono service in this matter. The court is greatly appreciative of the professionals involved. Case is submitted. Call the next case.